Presentation is on the topic Health Impacts of War in the Middle East. The presenter is Dr. Nancy Stoller. She is actually presenting a paper originally written by Dr. Alan Myers, who was scheduled to be here today but could not. He's actually in the Middle East with Alice Rothschild. Dr. Stoller will be presenting not only their paper but also additional comments that she has on the situation. She is a research professor from the University of California at Santa Cruz. She has visited the Middle East on 6 occasions in the last 8 years as a research professor, and she will include some comments in her presentation about that. Dr. Stoller, please.
I'd like to thank everyone for the opportunity to be here. I'm sorry that I have to replace Alan, but it's great to be in front of this audience and with this distinguished panel. Alan has asked me to read this message for him. I want to thank the Peace Caucus and Barry Levy and Vic Seidel for hosting this important session, and all of you for attending. It's my great regret that I can't be with you today. But as luck would have it, today is also the first day of a conference hosted by the Gaza Community Mental Health Program and the World Health Organization on siege and mental health. On Friday, October 17th, just a week or so ago, the conference was notified that the government of Israel had denied passage into Gaza of all 120 international conference participants. We regard this as a violation of academic freedom and medical neutrality. Yesterday, we held a protest and press conference at the Erez crossing into Gaza. Today, our health and human rights delegation, along with other international colleagues, is in Ramallah, participating in the conference by video link. The effect of military occupation on the health and welfare of the population of the occupied Palestinian territories is the subject of this presentation, and I'm grateful to Nancy Stoller for her willingness and ability to present in my place. The scale of the humanitarian crisis in the Palestinian occupied territories is reflected in these data from the United Nations consolidated appeals process. The UN's estimate of the need for humanitarian relief for the OPT is surpassed only by that of Sudan and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Since the armistice of 1949, the UN has maintained a presence throughout the West Bank and Gaza, administering refugee camps and monitoring the health and human rights of the civilian population through its Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Their data and reports are readily available online. One of the primary contributors to the current humanitarian crisis in the occupied territories is the regime of travel restrictions placed on the populations by the government of Israel. In the West Bank, which we'll talk about first, these consist of staff checkpoints, partial checkpoints, road gates, earthen mounds, road barriers, earth walls, road blocks, and trenches. On any given day, at any given time, the passage of a Palestinian civilian past these fixed and mobile checkpoints can be arbitrary, making access to work, education, and health care unpredictable and often impossible. As an example, this September 5th, after being refused passage by IDF soldiers, a Palestinian woman from the Kusra village gave birth to a stillborn child at the Huwara checkpoint just south of Nablus. The government of Israel is also building a physical barrier, which is projected to be twice the length of the 1949 armistice line or green line. You may have heard of this. Some people refer to it as the separation wall or separation fence. It's also sometimes called the apartheid wall. 87% of this barrier is located within the West Bank, cutting off Palestinian farmers from nearly 10% of the West Bank, including some of the most arable land and important water resources. Some 35,000 Palestinians now live in the so-called seam zone between the barrier and the green line, where life is increasingly difficult. This map shows the settled Palestinian population areas in beige, Israeli settlements in purple, the separation barrier in red, I hope you can see it, and the placement of various obstacles to travel for the Palestinians. Most of the fertile Jordan Valley is a closed military zone and is not accessible to Palestinians. OCHA estimates that nearly 40% of the West Bank is taken up by Israeli infrastructure. The obstacle settlements and settler-only bypass roads have effectively carved the territory remaining for the Palestinian population into a series of isolated enclaves, thus inhibiting administration, commerce, access to health care and education, and social unity for the residents. Revenues at East Jerusalem hospitals, which are supposed to be part of the West Bank, have fallen 40% in the last 2 years because fewer West Bank patients are able to attend consultations. The U.S. Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, the government of Israel, and the Palestinian Authority together negotiated an agreement on movement and access in November 2005, which was intended to promote peaceful economic development and improve the humanitarian situation on the ground. But in the latest report on implementation of this agreement, the UN notes that a 62% increase in obstacles since the signing of that agreement. This table from the most current UN report on implementation of the agreement on movement shows that the government of Israel has failed to implement its obligations under the agreement. The obstacles to movement within the West Bank have increased, and no work is currently ongoing to establish a plan to reduce obstacles. In its most recent closure update, OSHA concludes that in looking at the policy implemented for the past 8 years, one can note that what was once justified as a short-term military response to violent confrontations appears to have developed into a permanent system. Another issue is violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinian civilians, which appears to be increasing. According to OCHA, again, the lack of adequate law enforcement by Israeli authorities seems to be a key factor contributing to the persistence of the settler violence phenomenon over the years. I'd now like to turn to talking about Gaza, the other major occupied territory. Despite the withdrawal of Israeli settlements and military presence directly within Gaza in August 2005, conditions for the population have continued to deteriorate. Gaza remains encircled by the Israeli military, which controls all access of people and material into and out of the territory by land, sea, or air to anywhere. This is not just into Israel, but to anywhere. Ongoing restrictions of imports and exports through the crossing points continue to have crushing effects on the economy, the healthcare, and the social fabric of Gaza's 1.5 million people. Fishing industry has been crippled by Israel's enforcement of a 6 nautical mile fishing limit, which is also in violation of agreements that the Israeli government signed. A ceasefire between Gaza militants firing rockets into Israel and the Israeli military has been in effect for over 9 months. Israel indicated that with this ceasefire, it would allow more imports into Gaza. However, in September 2008, just last month, imports into Gaza were still only at 30% of the December 2005 level. Nearly half the imports are food. Restriction of fuel imports have been especially crippling. Since January 2008, the coastal municipality's water utility has received one-third of the fuel which it needs for normal operations. Since August 2008, it has received no deliveries and is unable to pump from half of its wells, leaving 250,000 people with a severe lack of water. Fuel and power shortages have crippled sewage treatment plants. Over a year ago, July 2007, Israeli authorities have restricted the entry of necessary spare parts already funded by the World Bank. Consequently, 50 to 60 million liters of raw and partially treated sewage have been flowing into the Mediterranean since early January this year. The World Health Organization found that coliform bacterial contamination on long stretches of the Gaza coast exists, but at this point we still have no completed studies on the effects of the contamination. Fishermen report that the sewage has killed most of the sea life in the Gaza harbor, except for, as you might expect, jellyfish. The Ashkelon desalination plant, which is in Israel just north of Gaza, also reports that seawater taken in by the plant has been polluted by sewage. We can see a number of effects of this Gaza blockade, which is within Gaza referred to as a siege, in case you've ever heard that phrasing. Tremendous rise in unemployment, businesses at only at less than 5% of their capacity, 98% of industrial operations inactive, many workers laid off in the last year. Household poverty has climbed to 80% from 63% in 2005. Difficulties in buying food and power cuts have led to outages at hospitals, which have been as long as 8 hours a day, affecting ICUs, surgical theaters, radiology, emergency departments, central suction, water pumps, and all kinds of services that people would ordinarily receive at a hospital. There are also, of course, nutritional effects. I'll just mention these. 13% of children who are less than five years old and 30% of children in North Gaza are chronically undernourished. Half of children 6 to 36 months of age anemic, and 45% of pregnant women also anemic. These are all data from the World Health Organization. 2 months ago, Physicians for Human Rights Israel published this report, which, among other things, documented that the proportion of Gaza patients who have been referred to external medical centers because services are not available for the serious needs that they have, services within Gaza, were denied passage by Israeli authorities. The rate of denial rose from 10% in the first half of 2007 to 35% in the first half of 2008. Since July 2007, the General Security Service, which is part of the military, and to some of you may know it as either the Shin Bet or the Shabak, has detained patients for interrogation at the Erez crossing, which is the primary crossing from Gaza into Israel, and requested them to either provide information directly or to act as collaborators on a regular basis as a condition for leaving Gaza. PHR argues in their report that this practice constitutes a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention and the UN Convention Against Torture. Additionally, in terms of mental health, a series of surveys was reviewed by the World Health Organization in 2007, which revealed the following findings: high level of sleeping problems, deteriorating family relationships, increased tension among children, high rates of daily anxiety, and a probably well-founded fear in some cases of losing their home or land or being displaced or uprooted. As I conclude my talk, I'm going to take you on a short trip. This young woman is named Jamila Diab. I met her this summer when I was in Gaza in July. Imagine that she has to have a crucial heart operation and has received permission to cross into Israel to go to a hospital in the West Bank. The next few slides will show you her route, that is, if she's not traveling by ambulance, which would be a slightly different route. This is the land route. Here we see a view of the Erez crossing from Gaza looking toward Israel. One must walk this distance or be pushed in a wheelchair by an approved porter. You walk from where I'm standing taking the picture to the farthest structure you can see to arrive at the terminal to be processed. You can't cross this unless you already have some kind of official permit. In this photo, you can see two Palestinian women being pulled in wheelchairs to the entrance to a structure called the tunnel, which enters the terminal. The tunnel is actually an above-ground structure which one traverses, and here's a photo from inside it. A view of the separation wall between Gaza and Israel looking from the tunnel passage. Gaza's on the other side of that wall. Still approaching the terminal via the passageway, the complete walk from where one leaves the Gaza checkpoint to entering the Israeli terminal is about a quarter of a mile. And if you're in a wheelchair or if you're using crutches, you have to cross it the same way. There's no other way to get there. This is a wheelchair and luggage transfer point. This is viewed from the Israeli side looking toward the separation wall. One of the many electronically operated gates within the terminal. A view of the terminal from the Israeli side, of course you can see you can park right in front of it, and what Jamila would see if she made her way through, she would then have to deal, and her family would have to deal with the issues of her return into Gaza. If she were receiving care in Jordan, she might not be able to get back into Gaza. This is another reason why some people don't even apply to travel. I leave you with this photo of Jamila and also with my hope that you and others at APHA will support this resolution, copies of which are on the table, which has been endorsed by the Medical Care Section, International Health Section, and International Human Rights Committee, which advocates for greater access to critical medical care for residents of Gaza. This resolution will be heard tomorrow at the Governing Council. Thank you very much.
We have time for one or two questions, if you'd raise your hand. Dr. Rubin, if you'd use the microphones, those asking questions.
I'm recording this. My name is Martin Rubin, and I would like to differ with you on a number of points. One of the main points being that, I would just like to preface one thing. Peace is not the absence of war, but peace is harmony. Now, in the crossings and all the other things in there, if they would stop putting bombs into Israel, which come in daily from Gaza, there would not be the need to have these stops at the border. These are searches that take place because explosives are being brought in. They do not seem to have a problem with getting explosives into Gaza, where they and working, and as time has gone on, the weapons have gotten more and more sophisticated, that they go over the border daily by the hundreds. And the ambulances have been carrying explosives. And going as far back as 2001, the International Red Cross said that Israel had the right to stop the ambulances because there were explosives coming in on the ambulances. Now, I'm old enough to have gone, to have lived through most of this. Now, in the 1930s, a Palestinian was a Jew, and the committee for a free Palestine that was on, had its offices on 42nd Street in Manhattan was started by Ann and A.L. Robeson. That, there's a lot of stories that go with that, but that was, well, free Palestine was to be a Jewish Palestine at that time. Now, the Israel has been under attack constantly, and these are the methods that they use to protect themselves. Now, if the Arabs would stop bombing, Israel would stop with these things. But they signed a peace treaty, and immediately bombs came over. Now, you saw it here last year. We had a doctor from Israel who put up, who show you the barriers that they put up on the hospital to prevent the rockets from coming in, rockets and mortars that come in. Now, they were continuing to treat patients, Arab patients there. They didn't look at whether it was an Arab or a Jew or a Muslim or whatever. All they were concerned about was the patient. But they still had to put up these barriers.
Maybe you could just summarize the rest in just a moment and give Dr. Stoller a chance to respond, please.
Okay, the only other thing I want to put out, hold for the time being, is the fact that at no point did Israel do any attack. Israel was attacked. Now, the point that I'm trying to make is I dislike very much occupied territories. Now, an occupied territory, you have to have occupied something that's owned by another country. These are disputed territories. These are not occupied territories. The last nation that was a nation in that area was Israel. Now, with the mandate that was given to the British in 1917, 1919, in that period of time, that mandate was for an Israeli Jewish state. And part of that land was divided up after the Arabs rebelled. That was the Arab uprising, and they split that and divided into a Jewish and an Arab state. The Arab state became Transjordan.
Thank you, Dr. Rubin. Let me give Dr. Stoller a chance to respond.
Thank you for your comments. First of all, we know war is hell, right? And what this presentation is about the consequences for residents of Gaza and residents of the West Bank in terms of how they have been affected by the conflict. It's not to say that every single thing that happened was the fault of Israel, or to say it's not about who is initially responsible for the ongoing conflict. The other thing I'd like to note is that the sources for the presentation are all from internationally respected organizations, and especially the World Health Organization, concerning the views of the World Health Organization about the primary sorts of interference with the public health situation and access to medical care for people who are in the occupied territories. And finally, I would just note that although it may be your position that the only country previously there was Israel, the position of the UN was that, and is, that Palestinians have a right to live free and unimpeded life in either Gaza or in the West Bank. Thank you.
Thank you.